We are going to hear now about an American city struggling to survive. Youngstown, Ohio, lost its steel mills years ago and has seen its population steadily shrink. Back in 2006, the city launched a bold new plan. The plan? Except that the city was going to be much smaller than it had been. Hannah Jaffe-Wall with our Planet Money team reports.
Before 2006 and the bold plan, there were other ideas, or rather, multiple variations on the same idea. Youngstown was going to replace the steel industry with a car factory. That never happened. Okay, with a NASCAR racetrack. Nope. With a riverboat casino. Never materialized. Same deal with a blimp factory that was supposedly going to open by the airport. Here's Mayor Jay Williams.
That was the mentality. It was grasping for straws. If you came in with what seemed to be even marginally viable economic idea, there was a rush to make that the thing that was going to save Youngstown.
In 2006, though, the city abandoned all that. Actually, the city walked away from the most fundamental assumption of economic development, of city planning, the idea that a city needs to grow. Here's Bill Davignon, head of Youngstown City Planning.
We needed, as a city, to recognize that we're a smaller city. We're not going to grow. We're never going to be the Youngstown that we thought we were going to be. And we needed to start to make decisions based on being a smaller city.
A smaller city of 82,000 people, according to the 2000 census. So they wrote a plan called it Youngstown 2010 that essentially said, let's stop obsessing about growth by the 2010 census and instead focus on maintaining the population we have. But without the dream of growth, Youngstown just had a bunch of empty houses that everyone had now accepted no one was ever coming back to.
They take the thing and just knock the home down. You know, the bulldozer knocks them down, tear them down every time.
This is Dolores Marie. She's 83 years old and lives on the southwest side of Youngstown. In 6 years, the city demolished nearly 2,000 abandoned buildings, mostly empty homes. Dolores has seen most of her block razed.
Whenever they decide to do it, they might knock down maybe two or three in the run of that week. And then they'll move down to another section and just do the same thing.
The problem with shrinking cities is that they don't shrink in a smart, organized way. It's chaotic. Thousands of people will leave one neighborhood and maybe five or a dozen people will stay behind. So Youngstown has been offering financial help for those people left behind, offering to move them to a place with more neighbors. Here's Bill Davignon again, the city planner.
The theory is that streets could be closed, the infrastructure no longer needed, trash would not have to be picked up in that area.
That would save the city a lot of money. But nearly everyone responded to the offer to move the way Dolores did.
I said, I have six kids I raise here. And I said another thing. I've been here. I don't even feel right moving in any other neighborhood. I want to be here.
So the plan is moving a little slower than expected. Bill says eventually the people left in these neighborhoods will move or they'll pass away and no one will come take over their houses. Then the city could close entire neighborhoods. But no one claims the plan has been wildly successful so far. Especially not after last week. The new Ohio 2010 census numbers came out. Youngstown's population shrank by 18% in the last decade.
You know, our goal of maintaining a mid-sized city, we haven't been successful at. We continue to lose population. We can't force people to stay in the city of Youngstown.
They can just follow the people who leave with their bulldozers, take down their homes, and hope that the population does eventually stabilize, while there's still some city left to enjoy. Hannah Jaffe-Walt, NPR News.
Oil prices dropped a bit today. The kind of oil that traders follow most closely is selling this evening for about $114 a barrel. But that's up about $18 over the price at the beginning of the year. There is a story behind this price rise. As NPR's Tom Gelton reports, oil traders are making judgments about what's likely to happen in the Middle East in the weeks and months ahead.
Generally, the market price of something is the result of two things, the supply of a product and the demand for it. But in the oil market, it's not so simple. Today's price reflects not just current supply and current demand, because buyers and sellers are making deals now for future oil deliveries. That requires them to make judgments about where world events are headed, whether there'll be wars or revolutions or something else that might bring about a halt in oil production.
In times like these, traders have to put on their geopolitical hats and, you know, their supply and demand hats.
Michael Wittner is Global Director of Oil Research for the French investment bank Société Générale. If oil traders are to have a sense of what a barrel of oil is really worth right now, he says, they have to think about where the situation in the Middle East and North Africa is headed. They have to follow the news.
The bottom line is, you know, the market has to make some sort of judgment or assumption about the risk of disruptions and generalized unrest at some point in the future.
If the price of oil today reflected just current supply and demand, it would be about $20 less than what it is. That extra $20 is what traders call the geopolitical risk premium. It's a very precise indicator of how worried oil traders are from one day to the next about what's likely to happen to oil production. Jim Burkhardt is Managing Director for Global Oil at IHS Cambridge Energy Research Associates.
Our knowledge of the world, our views of the future change every day. And the price of oil immediately reflects changes in the news, changes in our perceptions. It reflects our expectations, our beliefs on that particular day.
At Société Générale, Michael Wittner has identified three scenarios for oil production in the Middle East and North Africa. One, a continued shutdown of production in Libya. Two, a shutdown in a second medium-sized producer. Three, a shutdown in Saudi Arabia, the region's largest producer. Each scenario is associated with a particular oil price. Scenario 1 means a price range of $110 to $125 a barrel. That's exactly where we stand today. Bingo.
The market is assuming that the Libyan shutdown will last a while.
But the oil price, even for future deliveries, is nowhere near Michael Wittner's estimate of where it would be if traders thought scenarios 2 or 3 were likely.
The market is not assuming another shutdown in a medium-sized producer or a big producer like Saudi Arabia. The market is talking about that and thinking about it and worrying about it, but that's not actually what's in prices.
Of course, the price could change overnight. Analysts suggest different scenarios because it helps buyers and sellers make decisions about how much risk they're facing. Jim Burkhardt of IHS Cambridge Energy thinks of these as alternative stories about the future that his clients should ponder.
Since the future is so full of surprises, it can be quite risky to make that bet, taking into account just one vision of that future.
So you're wrong in thinking the troubles in the Middle East will be limited to Libya. These analysts can tell you how much it's likely to cost you, roughly another $30 a barrel. Tom Gelton, NPR News, Washington.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
While Japan remains focused on its damaged nuclear reactors and other urgent needs, the nation soon will have to address the damage to its economy. To discuss the economic challenges Japan will face, Kenneth Kukie, business and finance correspondent in Tokyo for The Economist magazine, joins us. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you.
We know it could be a long time before Japan gets a full accounting of the damage, but what are the early estimates on the cost of this quake?
The early estimates are kind of all over the map. We've seen things between 25 and 50 billion. It's now up to about 100 billion. That's presuming that there is quake damage and that there's tsunami damage. What will the estimate be if there's severe radiation damage? We don't know. It could be far, far higher.
This was an event of historic proportions. Business, commerce, transportation, power grids, infrastructure, they all were hit. Can you give us an assessment of what's functioning and what isn't?
Well, the first thing to know is that the northeast of Japan is not the industrial heartland of the country. There are obviously car factories. Nissan has a factory there. Toyota has two suppliers up there, Honda and others. Those factories are closed that are in the area, obviously. But what a lot of people may not understand is that the supply chains, particularly in Japan, are very, very tight. And so if a factory somewhere doesn't produce a widget, it has huge knock-on effects throughout the country at other factories that might be depending on that part. So we do know that most of the automakers are saying that they are not going to open up production tomorrow, or they're going to do it at maybe, I'd say, 4 out of 5 factories will be closed. I think one of the reasons for that as well is that they realize that there may not be the power, enough energy and electricity to power up their factories, so that they're realizing that this makes a sense for the nation and for their workers to just catch its breath.
Are you seeing shortages in basic necessities, food, water, medicine, shelter?
In the crisis area, yeah, obviously. And relief efforts are there to supply the basic necessities to people. Elsewhere in the country, there's minor shortages in the sense that deliveries might be impacted. It's also precautionary stockpiling. If there is another, if these other aftershocks become another big earthquake that creates a problem, you want to be stocked up.
Is it possible to assess what this is going to do to the long-term economic prospects for Japan?
Right now, if the nuclear catastrophe is averted, then you could imagine it's going to be probably a year of rebuilding. GDP will suffer initially because production will be lower. Then you will actually see a lot of the public spending kick in. So you actually may see, artificially, of course, the economy moving along because of all this government spending on infrastructure and rebuilding. Longer term, the Japanese economy was sickly and ailing prior to the earthquake. It still will have all the same problems when this incident is remedied that it had before, unless those other problems, those larger systemic problems, get addressed.
Kenneth Kukie is a business and finance correspondent for The Economist magazine. He joined us from his base in Tokyo. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to NPR News.
When disaster strikes anywhere in the world, Japan is one of the first countries to open its pocketbook. Japan is the second largest foreign aid donor in the world, due in large part to its huge economy. But given the billions of dollars in damage the country now faces, there are also concerns about what kind of impact it will have on the economy. Robert Madsen is a Japan scholar and senior fellow at MIT's Center for International Studies, and he joins me from Stanford in California. Robert, first of all, we are talking about a manufacturing powerhouse. Japan is a net exporter. Outline for us how the disaster could affect Japan's economy in the short to medium term.
The effects are different in the short and the medium term. You have to remember that Japan is a country that has been either in or on the verge of recession for over 20 years. Mm. And the major reason for that is that there's simply not enough domestic spending. In that sense, anything which causes government to or companies to spend more actually helps the economy. And the precedent for this is the 1995 Kobe earthquake.
Right.
A great deal of damage was done to the economy. And over the next couple of years, companies and the government had to spend massive amounts of money rebuilding infrastructure and factories. So if we use that and apply that as an analogy to today's situation, in the short term, of course, because there's been so much disruption, growth will decelerate. But over the medium term, say the next 2 or 3 years, my guess is that there will be a massive increase in spending on plant and equipment and highways and ports. So Japan's economy is likely to grow significantly faster as a result of this crisis over the medium term.
Even though the economy shrunk last year. Let me ask you about oil for a moment because, of course, we've seen huge spikes in prices in recent months, obviously because of the instability in North Africa and the Middle East. Now, given the unfolding crisis with those nuclear power plants in Fukushima, could that have the effect of increasing demand for oil?
If you look at demand for oil globally, because of the growth of India, China, a few other major economies, growth was trending upward very significantly. Now, if the events in Japan discredit nuclear power globally, we'll see China and some of these other countries cut back on their investment in nuclear facilities, which translates directly into much stronger demand for oil. So one of the things I would be worried about is that oil prices, which have been going up, are likely to go up significantly more. I think we're all going to pay a lot more at the pump.
Japan is also a major investor overseas. Could we start seeing Japanese money pulled from foreign markets? And if so, what kind of impact might that have on the global economy?
Yes. At least in the short term, Japan is going to have to repatriate a lot of the money it's invested abroad in order to pay for the reconstruction of all the factories and other things within the country that have been damaged. So that would suggest that the yen will strengthen in the short term. Money will probably flow out of the major Western investment markets, the U.S. Treasury market and other places, possibly pushing up interest rates a little bit. That, of course, will make things much more difficult for the Federal Reserve, because now they're going to have probably upward pressure on interest rates in the United States, which would mean they'd like to loosen. But they can't loosen if oil prices and other commodity prices are increasing, which now seems more likely. So I think in a number of different countries, this makes the conduct of monetary policy a lot more difficult.
That's some sobering news from economist Robert Madsen. He's a Japan scholar at MIT's Center for International Studies. Robert, thank you.
A pleasure.